Now, by the way, last week we started talking about Hitler, and I didn't really want to spend too much time tonight on him, but I had mentioned that his book had been out of print in Germany ever since the end of World War II. Well, actually, it's going back into print in Germany, and again, Christy sent me an article to that effect, and so the German government is actually funding a new edition of Mein Kampf. Apparently, it's going to be heavy with commentary, and I'm sure it'll be anti-Nazi commentary. But nonetheless, it's spurred an awful lot of controversy in Germany, just the very idea that this book would be back in circulation. Okay, but you know, not being, generally speaking, not being an advocate of book burning or whatever, you know, people will get the book if they want it badly enough anyway, and probably better to have an edited version of Mein Kampf, you know, to hopefully explain some of the fallacies and lies and distortions and so on of the book than not to have something like that available at all. So. All right. Well, anything before we get started? Okay. All right. Well, let's start by taking a look at very briefly that Satan's bookshelf takeaway points, because I think, you know, periodically we'd want to go back and do this since we're covering such a lot of material in this course and a lot of books and authors and so on. So we'll do this very, very rapidly. But remember our basic thesis. And that is that all of these books are terribly flawed, okay? And the central fallacy in every one of these books is a misunderstanding of the nature and character of God, from which we get our ideas of moral consciousness. And by extension, if we have a flawed understanding of the nature and character of God, we'll also have a flawed understanding of our understanding of the nature and character of humanity. And so most of these authors, not all, but most were atheists, and they were all opposed to traditional Orthodox Christianity. Now, a few of these authors claim to be Christians, but of course, are radically out of sync with traditional biblical Orthodox Christianity. So we start with Machiavelli. What's the problem with that book? Well, now, okay, imagine, see, if you actually believed what these authors are trying to preach, okay, what kind of a person would you be, okay? Let's start with Machiavelli. This world is a competitive jungle, okay? That doesn't leave a whole lot of space for compassion and love and whatever, self-sacrifice, to say the least. Given the realities of human nature, biblical morality is just hopelessly naive and unrealistic. So this is a pretty bad place to begin, and but imagine if you actually believe that. Many, many people, of course, do believe that. And so self-interest and pragmatism, not moral principles, should guide our thoughts and words and actions. So, I mean, if that were the only book we were studying, the repercussions would be very, very serious, but that's just our launch point, okay? Let's move on to Leviathan. Human beings are innately egoistic, predatory animals. Now, remember, why would an arch-heretic like Thomas Hobbes, why would he have such a bleak, pessimistic view of human nature? Well, that's because he's living before the Enlightenment, when things shifted dramatically to the other extreme, that human beings are good and reasonable and so on. So he actually has a more realistic understanding of human nature than what would come later. But based on his very bleak understanding of human nature, we need authoritarian government in order to control human beings who are really just wild animals. Okay, so he is denying the imago Dei, the idea that we are infused with a moral conscience, having been created in the image of God. And of course, somebody like Hitler would be fully in accord with Hobbes' ideas there in Leviathan, that you need authoritarian government to keep people under control. Then we move on to David Hume, and remember we did a couple of philosophical books, and Hume basically arguing that rational philosophy, and by extension biblical theology, it really can't even defend what it purports to teach. He's totally wrong about this, but that's his thesis. And by the way, if that were true, that for instance, Christianity is really just a fideistic belief system. It's all about just blind faith. You can't defend anything that Christians believe or that the Bible seems to teach. If that were true, then of course, why would you want to believe it? If you can't defend something rationally or factually, why would you want to believe it? That's just fideism, and that's a total suspension of critical thinking, okay? But that's what he teaches, and many people believe that. Then Kant tells us that reason has its limitations. Well, obviously that's true, but he also goes on to say we have no basis for assuming that our perceptions of reality even correspond to reality itself. Now, again, imagine if you actually believed that. You couldn't commit to anything if you actually seriously believed that we can't really perceive reality and truth, that it's all just sensations and emotions. See, if you actually believed that, why would you ever want to commit to anything? Or certainly, why would you ever want to commit to Jesus Christ? Then with Jean-Jacques Rousseau, of course, now here we've gone into the Age of Enlightenment, a highly optimistic, in fact, a naively optimistic idea that this world can be perfected and that human beings are innately good and reasonable, but he understands that history is a bloody mess. And why is it a bloody mess? Well, because we've got these unjust social and economic and political systems. So people are good, but institutions and systems are bad. And as we've talked about, I mean, that's just patently irrational, but a lot of people believe that. So if you actually believe that, then you would believe that the solution is a society that operates according to reason and what he called the social contract. But there's so many internal contradictions into what he teaches that I don't think any sensible person could buy into that. Now, we said Joseph Smith's Book of Mormon. Well, that's a unique book, okay? That's totally out of sync with the whole flow of Western history. And so it kind of hangs out there on its own, you know, as a new revelation from God. And the LDS Church is the only true and living church upon the face of the whole earth. Well, only Mormons would believe that. All right, so getting back into the flow, though, Feuerbach, God is an illusion. He's a dream of the human soul, and we'll see how that correlates so well with Sigmund Freud's ideas. Ernest Renan, I used him as an example of one of those who would try to deconstruct the New Testament and the Gospels and try to argue that we can know little, if anything, about the real historical Jesus from reading the Bible, from reading the New Testament. So separating the Jesus of history from the Christ of myth. And of course, their point there is that Christ, who we call Christ, is really just an imaginary construct of Christians a century or two after the time of the historical Jesus, of whom we know virtually nothing about. Now, what he does to the New Testament, Julius Wellhausen will try to do to the Old Testament, starting with a critique of the Pentateuch. It wasn't really written by Moses. It was a product of a literary synthesis centuries after Moses. His evidence and arguments are unconvincing, to say the least. But again, see, if you actually believe all of this, then there's no reason to put any faith and confidence in the New Testament or the Old Testament. They're both totally unreliable. Okay, Karl Marx, The basis of all current and previous societies has been the exploitation of the poor by the rich. Well, that's been true a lot, but it's also a rather simplistic analysis of history. History is multi-causational, and only a simpleton, frankly, would believe that history can be explained by one causal factor, such as Marx is putting forth. So he'll argue history is determined exclusively by economic forces, the struggle for the control of the means of production. The goal of history is an egalitarian, classless society in which private property is abolished. Now, how does he know that's the goal of history? See, he writes as if he's divinely inspired, except that he's an atheist, and only somebody who's writing under divine inspiration could claim that there's a goal to history. And even if there were a goal to history, why would it be a classless society in which private property is abolished? You would have to think that human beings are all equal. And, you know, we talk about equality in the sight of God, but that's totally different. There's no two human beings on earth who are exactly equal. We're all unique in that respect. In fact, when you think about it, you're not even equal to yourself from one day to the next. You know, you have better days than others, and some days you're a whole lot sharper than you are other days, and so on. So, I mean, this is just silly and naive. But what is utopia on earth? Well, it's the transition from a competitive and unjust and capitalistic society into a pure communistic society that's achievable by means of the dictatorship of the proletariat. In other words, the Communist Party has to usher in this period of utopia. And we know historically that that's been an absolute disaster. And, you know, if some theory just hangs out there disconnected from real life experiences, there's good reason to question the legitimacy of the theory. If it doesn't comport with reality, obviously there's something wrong with the theory. All right, now if you buy into John Stuart Mill, like many people do, you would believe that the goal in life, and again, see, here's somebody who's an atheist, so how can he possibly be talking about a goal in life? How can he possibly be bringing in a teleological argument as if there's a goal or a purpose in life if you don't believe in a God? But anyway, according to him, the goal or purpose of life is individual happiness. And I think a lot of people would agree with him. Can you imagine anything more unbiblical than that idea? See, now, we oftentimes don't think of Mill as being as evil as, you know, Marx and Feuerbach and some of these others, but I would argue that's just as evil, that idea is just as evil as anything Darwin or Marx ever wrote. You have any thoughts on that? Any comments? Yeah, Ray.
Karl Marx.
Mm-hmm. Seriously? She said that? Really?
Yes.
That's interesting. So here's somebody who lives off the charity of a wealthy friend who was the son of a wealthy capitalist. And as you say, he hardly held a steady job his whole life. And but, you know, for socialists, that doesn't matter. Yeah.
I remember back in the late 80s, the Atlanta Hawks basketball team, somehow they worked it out to go play in the Soviet Union against the Soviet basketball team. So they check into this, by Soviet standards, five-star hotel, which by our standards would be well below a Motel 6 or something. And And of course, these Atlanta Hawks players, they're used to being pampered and all, you know. And so
nothing works in this hotel, including the hot water. It doesn't work. So they call down to the front desk and complain. And it's so obvious, the clerk at the front desk could not care less. You know, it's like, your hot water doesn't work. Oh, well, so. And I remember reading about it, and it just struck me as so indicative of, again, a society in which there's just, you know, everybody's guaranteed a job, but everybody's on welfare, essentially, but everybody's so cynical and everything. Yes, John. Yeah, the economist at Georgia State.
Yeah. Went on an economic exchange program to Russia. And he came back and said one of the things that really struck him was that in the U.S., our macroeconomics is intended to maximize the benefit to many. And in Russia, their macroeconomic premise is to minimize the cost of supporting the populace.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, fundamental problem there. Yeah. Oh, another funny thing. One of these Atlanta Hawks players calls down to the front desk and complains there's no towels, you know, in the room. And the person down at the desk is like, so? What do you expect me to do about it? You know, I mean, the very idea of actually responding and servicing, you know, your guests was just the furthest thing from their mind. Okay, well, let's move on. Charles Darwin, Origin of the Species and the Descent of Man. You want an outline? Human beings are not created in the image of God. Hey, welcome. How you doing? Here's one more, okay? Yeah, okay. Human beings are not created in the Imago Dei, but they're products of naturalistic, random, and purposeless processes at work. Now, again, see, if you believe that, then you couldn't possibly believe in teleology. You couldn't possibly believe there's any goal or purpose in life if you believe that everything is naturalistic, materialistic, random, and purposeless. Just as natural selection, survival of the fittest rule in the animal kingdom, these forces regulate the ongoing evolution of human beings. But all this operates according to genetic mutations. And we know from biology that overwhelmingly genetic mutations are negative. They're not positive. And yet Darwin, who didn't know much at all, in fact, I guess he knew nothing about genetics, actually, would claim that it's genetics that are driving evolution. But the evidence would argue very strongly just the other direction. It's devolutionary. And then, as we said a week or so ago, Darwin's doubt, the horrid doubt always arises whether the convictions of my mind, which has been developed from the mind of, you know, an ape or some lower animal, are of any value or trustworthy. And it's a good question. And Darwin wondered, you know, how can I actually even trust my mind? I mean, it's just developed naturalistically from a lower, you know, from a primate and on back to the beginning. So why should we put any trust and confidence in anything we think? So that kind of takes us back to Kant, doesn't it? And that is, do we really even have the capacity to perceive reality? Then with Nietzsche, imagine believing this. Life has no meaning and purpose. To survive and thrive, we must acquire the will to power in order to dominate and subjugate and, if necessary, annihilate our competition. But by the way, if life had no meaning and purpose, why would you even want to do that? I mean, where does the will to power come from? What's the purpose? What's the point? God is dead, and the future of humanity is one of unprecedented chaos, war, and totalitarianism. So as we said, I mean, the man was, in a sense, kind of a secular prophet. He understood very well the consequences of the death of God. In other words, the total collapse of a Christian-influenced civilization, such as Europe was. And then with Hitler, of course, using Darwinian principles of natural selection and survival of the fittest, we must advance the process of human evolution through racial purification. Now, actually, this makes a little more sense if your goal in life, but again, that's nonsensical in itself if you're an atheist, but if there were a goal in life, and if that goal were human evolution, then of course you'd want to do everything you could to purify the racial and genetic composition of humanity. But again, you must ask, why would anybody want to do that who doesn't believe in the biblical God? Makes no sense whatsoever. See, these people are all implying that we have a calling in life, which is absurd if you don't believe in, the God of the Bible. So what's the goal of it all? Well, utopia, a utopian society. But again, see, if I were not a Christian, and especially if I were some atheist or whatever, why would I care about a utopian society? I'm not going to be here much longer. Why should I care what the world is like when I die? When I die, it's annihilationism. You just cease to exist in any conscious form. You're no longer a sentient being. And so why should I care one bit what the world is like in 2 or 3 years? Or no, hopefully it'll be more like a little longer than that. But after I'm gone. So again, imagine people actually believing this. And would it leave any reason to live whatsoever? Any purpose in life whatsoever? But why? I mean, it's all going to be over soon. So what difference does it make if you're happy for a few years? You're going to die and cease to exist. So, Dan?
Mm-hmm. A bigger canvas on which to paint our glory.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you be part of this? And if you won't be part of this, well, we have a place for you also.
Right. And I would say, again, I won't even know once I'm dead. I'll cease to exist. So why on earth should I care?
You'll know as you go to your deathbed that you were part of this.
I would die with a sense of satisfaction.
That's right.
Okay. Chai, I seriously doubt that. Okay. All right. Okay, any other thoughts? So anyway, I think it's good, to, again, go back and sort of review where we've been because, again, we are covering so much ground and so many aberrant belief systems and so on. And especially in a course like this, it's easy to sort of everything get jumbled and confused. All right, well, last week, as I said, we started out talking a bit about Hitler. I don't want to spend much time on this. Frankly, I don't find him very interesting compared to a lot of these other people we've talked about. And, of course, he probably remains the most hated, despised person in certainly the last several centuries. And so... do his ideas have a whole lot of traction? Well, it does among some, racists and so on. But most people, including most non-Christians, despise the man. And so, frankly, somebody like Nietzsche or Freud has been far more influential. Now, Hitler created chaos in the world for a few years. But fortunately, it was only a few, and then he was dead and gone, and he's been largely discredited ever since, again, except among hardcore racists. So for that reason, I didn't think we'd give him too much time and attention. But we did talk about where his ideas about life come through come from. That's that section in your notes that I call the Witch's Brew. And it's kind of a combination of German nationalism, Machiavellian power politics, these ideas that he got from Hobbes about totalitarian government being necessary. He picks up ideas from Nietzsche that you know, we have to have the will to power, and those who have the will to power have a great advantage over other people that vacillate in this life in terms of their commitments and so on. One thing you can say about Hitler and the Nazis was they were absolutely committed to their cause, and that's why they were able to prevail and dominate for a while there. Then from Darwin, he picks up the survival of the fittest evolutionary ideal, and as Rudolf Hess said on one occasion, National Socialism is nothing but applied biology. We're just helping evolution accomplish its ends. And then race-based eugenics, and of course this idea of Aryan superiority and so on. Now, there's been a tendency ever since World War II to dismiss Hitler as a madman, as an evil madman. And I think Benjamin Weicker in his book, 10 Books That Screwed Up the World, casts it, I think, in a much more thoughtful way. He says, you know, Hitler, we have to look at Hitler as a utopian visionary. He did have a vision for a utopian society. And he was not an evil madman. He was an evil genius who hoped to create a perfect society according to his own values and his own prejudices. And certainly Hitler saw himself as a rare leader in human history. He imagined himself a genuinely great statesman who combined the genius of a political philosopher along with being a great practical political leader. In other words, Hitler at least sees himself as the personification of a modern philosopher king, the old Platonic idea of a philosopher king. Benjamin Weicker puts it this way: many people who've read books about Hitler, but very few have actually read Mein Kampf, the danger of only reading about Hitler is that you can get a very distorted view of him as an evil madman instead of an evil genius. Now, a madman is driven by mania for a very particular idea. A genius, on the other hand, is driven by a grand vision, a malignant worldview. And he does have a grand vision, a grand utopian vision. Now, he grows up in Austria, and as a youth, he enjoys studying history. He admires greatly the German nation. And as you know, Austria is, I think, mostly German, isn't it, ethnically and so on. It's kind of, it's basically a German culture. And so he becomes a very ardent German nationalist. He very much admired Otto von Bismarck, who was the founder back in the 1800s of the German empire. Otto von Bismarck, also a very strong practitioner and advocate of what we were calling a few weeks ago Realpolitik, that we associated with Machiavelli and Hobbes and so on. And following the deaths of his parents when he was a teenager, Hitler moves to Vienna to study architecture. He's struggling to survive, and while he's in Vienna, and again, see, now he's an orphan, he witnesses firsthand the very degrading poverty of the lower classes. And he concludes that the problem here is that capitalism only works for the affluent bourgeois class in society. And it's this bourgeois elite that profit off of the social order, and it's that bourgeois elite that have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo. And so, according to Hitler, the solution can only come through major transformation of capitalism, or as he writes in Mein Kampf, during my struggle for existence in Vienna, I perceived very clearly that the goal of all social concern must never be merely sentimental charity, which is ridiculous and useless. Why? Well, because that just makes people dependents. It's tantamount to treating people as children, see? And he understands that. But it must rather be a means to find a way of eliminating the fundamental deficiencies which necessarily bring about the degradation of the individual. So in other words, he understands that there are social economic deficiencies in Austrian society and political deficiencies, and that's at the root of this terrible problem between, you know, the rich and the poor. So, but there's a difference, and that sounds kind of like Karl Marx, but there's a fundamental difference, obviously, in what Hitler proposes as the solution as opposed to Karl Marx. Unlike the Marxists, who believe that the solution to capitalistic exploitation was a worldwide communist revolution and the abolition of all private property, and also the elimination of all nation states, by the way, Hitler's solution is very nationalistic and very racial. And so he'll advocate a strong, unified, ethnically pure German state. As one of his biographers puts it, Hitler viewed nations as racial entities, biologically based societies. And so Hitler will put it this way: the state is a community of living beings who have kindred physical and spiritual natures, organized for the purpose of assuring the conservation of their own kind and to help toward fulfilling those ends which Providence has assigned to that particular race. So he often refers in his early writings to Providence. Now, he never really talks about, you know, the biblical God. That's going way too far. The man was probably an atheist all along, but he finds it useful to speak of Providence, which again is kind of odd for a non-believer. But again, see, he must believe that there's a goal and a purpose in life, and he'll call that Providence, whatever that guiding force is, see. And he goes on to say, therein and therein alone lie the purpose and the meaning of the state. So racial superiority should be the real basis for nationhood. Otherwise, he says, people, there's too much dysfunctionality in a society. It's not cohesive enough. It's not unified enough. You have to have a racially purified society in order to have a society that works. In other words, a polyglot society or racially mixed society or something like the United States always was, he would consider to be just a recipe for absolute failure. Hitler puts it this way. He says, a man will die for an ideal, but a man will not die for a business. See, and this is his critique of communism, and that is that Karl Marx reduced everything to economics and business and whatever, and Hitler says, no, people don't fight and die and bleed for economics, but they will fight and die and bleed for a grand ideal. And that's what he wants to offer the German people, is a grand utopian ideal, how we can have if not a perfect society, a far better society than we currently have. Now, what's the major hang-up to this great society? Well, it's Germany's full of Jews. And so he believes that Jews are behind the very powerful banking and commercial industries in Germany, and that they're ultimately to blame for the exploitation of the working class. See, Hitler will blame Jewish capitalists as being essentially the problem. But then he also recognizes that many of the early communists and leaders in the Bolshevik movement, for instance, in Russia, were Jews as well. So, and this is why Jews get it from both sides in the early 20th century. There are many people that are pointing out that Jews control various key industries, like the banking industry, for instance. Here in America, the argument oftentimes was that Jews were in control of Hollywood and the music industry and so on. And so there's many who want to blame the Jews, you know, for being, to use a Marxian term, capitalist pigs. On the other hand, others are going to be pointing out that, hey, an inordinate number of communists and Bolsheviks and revolutionaries are Jews as well. So they're getting it from both sides, see, and they're caught in between. He'll sort of launch his campaign against the Jews, you know, on those bases. And he'll argue that there's three great threats to German civilization. One is capitalism, with, again, this terrible maldistribution of wealth and this huge gap between the rich and the poor. And then another threat to Germany is Marxism, communism. And a third threat to Germany are the Jews, because the Jews are very much involved in both capitalistic exploitation and in communist revolutionary activities. So hopefully, without going the next steps in terms of where does all this anti-Semitism come from? I mean, that's kind of another issue which would take a while to unpack. But hopefully that helps in terms of why there was such anti-Semitism throughout Europe and, you know, to some extent here in America as well. Any thoughts or questions on any of that before we move on?
You know, we're... And their commitment to religious weaknesses.
Okay.
Communism is my life, my religion, my hobby, my girlfriend, my wife, my love, my bread, and my flesh. I work for her during the day. I dream of her at night. Her power over me grows. It doesn't diminish during the passing of time. That's why I can't have a friendship, a relationship, or a conversation without relating it to that strength that is the guide of my life. I evaluate people, their ideas, their actions, how they affect the communist cause. Been in jail for my ideals, and I'm ready to face death.
Wow. By the way, who did write that?
It doesn't say, it just says the communist leader during the Cold War.
Could sound like a Christian, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, we do need to understand that there were sincere communists who believed that the greatest problem in the world was wealth inequality. And that was the source of all of our problems, or most of our problems. So they weren't all, you know, necessarily evil. But how are you going to be able to enforce an equal society? Say, well, it's going to have to come by way of totalitarian government, isn't it? Because people are just not equal. And the only way that you could possibly try to make them equal is by... government control over people's lives. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's quite an impressive quote. Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts? Okay, so it's based on that those struggles he has as a young man before World War I, when he realized that his calling was to join the German army and fight for the Kaiser and so on. That was his goal, and that was his calling in life. Before that, he's most concerned with, capitalistic exploitation, and that's why he's drawn to what was called at the time the German Workers' Party. Well, basically German Socialist Party, see? That German Workers' Party later changed their name to the National Socialist German Workers' Party, and then eventually condense it down into Nazi, and they call it the Nazi Party. But it's a left-wing socialist political party. It has some fundamental differences with Marxism and communism. But having said that, the two are more alike than they are different, and that's why it's so intellectually dishonest to call communism left-wing and Nazism right-wing. And, of course, that delineation was actually promoted by the cultural Marxists in the Frankfurt School in the 1930s and 40s. They're the ones who promoted that false dichotomy between Nazism being right-wing and Marxism being left-wing. It's just propaganda, and it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. They're more alike than they are different. So unless you have any other thoughts on Hitler, I'd really like to move on and spend the rest of our time on Sigmund Freud. But anything in particular? So he's a socialist, as the Marxists are a certain type of socialist. So why is it that communism and Marxism haven't been so severely criticized and discredited as opposed to Hitlerian Nazism? Well, I think it's, because of what the Nazis did in the war. But beside that, it's because of the racial component. And, there is such a thing as human social evolution. And in most respects, as we've transitioned from a society and a civilization that was very much influenced by Christian values in the past to being an explicitly secular post-Christian society, we understand that there are certain repercussions that come from that. Now, with Hitler and the Nazi movement, with their emphasis on racism, part of, I think, 20th century human social evolution has been a discrediting of racism. And so not everything that's happened over the last 100 years is necessarily bad. I'd say most of it has been bad, but not all. And today, it's not socially acceptable to be a racist. And it was decades ago. And so I think we'd all have to agree that that's great. That's an improvement. It's at least in Western societies, it's not as socially acceptable to be a male chauvinist pig, to be a sexist. But it was generations ago. It's not anymore. And we all ought to be very, very grateful for that women are treated, with much more, or at least in certain areas of life, treated with more respect and treated more as equals than was the case in the past. So again, social evolution, not everything has gotten worse. There are some exceptions. Bob? You're right. So in the hands of dishonest people, environmentalism, care for the earth. We're called to be stewards of the earth. We're not called to be exploiters of the earth. But in the hands of dishonest people, agenda-driven people, environmentalism can become a religion, a false religion, a return to paganism, basically, a worship of nature. So everything can get corrupted by evil people. Yes, Jack?
I see your next section deals with Hitler and the church. You may have mentioned something about this last week. I'm sorry, I missed it. Germany was such a deeply Christian nation, it seemed. And then you read about Bonhoeffer, how he stood up against the atrocities of Hitler, but he seemed so unique to the rest of the church.
Well, we did actually cover that, good question. Germany was the cradle of the Reformation, but by the 19th century, it had become, Christianity in Germany had become so extremely liberal, theologically liberal, that Luther would never have recognized it. He would never have recognized probably the mainstream Lutheran church from his day. It had been so tainted by theological liberalism. So secularistic forces and influences have thoroughly corrupted and infiltrated German religion by the turn of late 1800s and turn of the 20th century. The Catholic Church, the Lutheran Church, the Reformed churches in Germany, they're all overwhelmingly liberal at this time. Now, the thing here, see, is that, and by the way, most of Germany's Jews were secular Jews. They were not serious practicing Jews religiously. And so when you have a country in which most of the so-called Christians have departed from biblical truth, in other words, they've become liberal Christians, if Christians at all, and then you've got secular Jews, see, both of these groups would have very flexible doctrines, doctrines that basically change according to the tenor of the times, which means that liberal Christians and secular Jews are going to be a whole lot more compliant when it comes to compromising on Christian and traditionally Jewish values and beliefs. And so they were easily corrupted by the Nazi regime. And of course, many caved in under very intense pressure as well. But you're right, as a whole, the Catholic Church offered little resistance to the Nazis. In fact, the Pope in Rome at the time has oftentimes been criticized, probably with some justice, for being way too compromising, you know, toward Mussolini and so on. But the Protestant Christians as well offered relatively little resistance. And so we look back, you know, at heroic figures like Bonhoeffer, who was part of the Confessing Church. But we have to keep in mind that that Confessing Church movement was a very much of a minority movement. It was a few Lutheran and a few Reformed pastors and church leaders, but it in no way represented the majority of Lutherans and Reformed Christians in Germany. And by the way, some of those that were involved early on in the Confessing Church movement later capitulated to the Nazis, again, under pressure and so on. So there were obviously Christians that were thrown into concentration camps and murdered, along with all the Jews and all the political enemies of the Nazis. But the number of Christians who were martyred was surprisingly small. Yeah, there were probably more gypsies annihilated during the Holocaust than Christians. So it's pathetic. But that's what happens with compromised liberal Christianity. You can always just continue to compromise on core beliefs and values and practices.
Yeah. The Altrucian people that were killed by the millions at the same time as the Jews.
How do you spell it?
A-L-T-R-U-S-I-N?
I don't know. Does anybody?
Many more millions of Altrucians were killed.
Altrucians. Does anybody know what that means?
Alsatians?
You're not talking about not Alsatians. Yeah, okay. I don't know. I'll have to, you know, plead innocent or ignorant on that. Does anybody know Altrucians? I'll look it up, or if you come up with anything, let me know. That would be interesting. So, Jack, I hope that helps a little bit. The Nazi movement actually started way back at the early stages of the 20th century as an occult movement. These people were into witchcraft and the occult. Satanic stuff. And people like Himmler continued to be very involved in the occult and the SS and so on, you know. So it was a demonic movement from the beginning, which became a widespread political movement. Yeah. So I hope that helps at least a little bit. But yes, unfortunately, there was not as much reaction as you would have thought from the Christians in Germany. And yet, again, see, many Jews since World War II, well, I don't know how many, but some Jews actually think Germany was a Christian country. And they even think Hitler was a, quote, Christian because he was raised Catholic. And nothing could be further from the truth, but in the minds of some Jews, they were being persecuted by Christians. All right, well, let's move on to something even worse. And that is, as we said, things don't get any better in this course. Okay, let's move on to Sigmund Freud here. All right, and in particular, we'll focus on his book, The Future of an Illusion, but he wrote numerous books, including at least three major books that primarily were anti-Christian diatribes. But first of all, we need to set the stage, and this may take longer than we have this evening, because Freud is one of these people like Darwin and Marx and maybe Nietzsche, who I think we really ought to devote sufficient time to, because he is so influential. Now, most psychologists and psychiatrists today, very few of them would claim to be, quote, Freudians. The general mentality in psychology and psychology and psychiatry is that we've moved beyond Freud. We've evolved, you know, that those fields of study have evolved beyond Sigmund Freud. But still, he exerts quite a bit of influence. Whether somebody claims to be a strict Freudian or not is almost immaterial. So Freud, I think, injects two very insidious ideas into the bloodstream of Western culture. One is that belief in God is an infantile illusion. In other words, belief in God is for children who can't face the realities of the real world. And again, you say, well, we've heard that before from Feuerbach. And yes, he was influenced by Feuerbach. Secondly, human beings are driven not by moral sensibilities, but by primal instincts, in particular, the sex drive. Now, again, this sounds like, well, you know, this is very compatible with Darwinism, and that is that there is no moral structure to the universe. The universe just is. And that being the case, we're just highly evolved animals. But Freud would say, well, he would agree with all that, but he would say what really drives us, the strongest motivating factor, is the sex drive. Now, intellectually, again, he's very much influenced by Darwinian naturalism, and like Feuerbach before him, Freud holds that belief in God is a human invention, or what he calls a dream of the human soul. And so, for instance, in this book, The Future of an Illusion, Freud writes that it would be very nice if there was a God who created the world and who was nice, who's a benevolent providence. And it would be nice if there was a moral order to the universe, and it would be really nice if there was an afterlife. But of course, all this is merely a fantasy, according to Freud. Now, likewise, morality is merely a human construct. He obviously is a moral relativist, as probably every single one of these people we've talked about is a moral relativist. And so he would argue that in its natural state, humanity is driven by just instincts. And you can't say that instincts are moral. You also can't say that instincts are immoral. They just are. So we'll call them amoral. Among the most powerful of these amoral instincts is the sex drive. Now, by the way, we oftentimes use that word amoral. I'm not even sure there is such a thing as amorality. I mean, something is either moral or it's not moral, right? I mean, can you think of anything that's...
You say potato, I say potato. I mean, there are things that are not
yeah, but
morally distinct. Right? I mean, you like, you know...
But nobody would say that mispronouncing a word is amoral. It's just, you know, incorrect. Right.
That's what Norman Lear tried to do with his People for the American Way. He started up in 1979 or 80.
Uh-huh.
Was try to show that all of the concerns of conservative Christians were merely personal preferences.
Which
we were trying to illegitimately impose upon the
sure.
nation as a whole,
sure.
rather than moral laws that everybody is under.
But to use the word moral implies that we're talking about right and wrong.
Right.
Not preferences in terms of ice cream flavors or something. Yeah. So is there such a thing as amoral?
There are people who think that there's that.
Yeah,
They're sort of creating their own, what do they call it? I mean, pulling themselves from the rock, you know, they're creating their own worldview.
Well, like there are people who would say, okay, to succeed in the business world, in corporate America or whatever, you have to act amorally, you know, because it's going to create terrible complications if you are moral driven in an environment like that where the ultimate goal is to make money, purely to make money. But see, I'd say, no, they're wrong. You can't act amorally. You either act according to goodness or you don't. Bob?
C.S. Lewis brings that out pretty well in his Introduction to Mere Christianity. That, you know, before he starts in the book, it's,
does he deal with this issue of amorality?
If a person does not morality, but belief in God and belief in...
Yeah.
He says that anybody that says they have no morals...
Uh-huh.
And,
oh, well,
soon in the conversation, it's going to
right.
be, well, they're going to say, no, that's not fair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's a morale.
Right,
moral
right,
statement.
Right. And I think he's absolutely correct about all that. But, again, we're talking about, is there anything that is a question of right and wrong, good and evil, that we can say is amoral? I'm not sure that term even applies, you know. So anyway, well, let's talk about Freud here. He's an Austrian. He's a neurologist. He's oftentimes referred to as the father of psychoanalysis. Throughout his adult life, he proudly pronounces himself a godless Jew. And he calls himself on one occasion one of the most dangerous enemies of religion. He's very, very proud of that. Now, he grows up in a very secular Jewish family in Vienna, Austria. So, you know, like Hitler, here we have another Austrian to deal with. And he has no strong religious foundation or interest, for that matter. And yet, despite the fact that they were secular Jews, not religious Jews, the Freud family was subjected to an awful lot of anti-Semitism and in Catholic Austria, which probably accounts for a lot of his hostility toward Christianity. His understanding of Christianity was Catholic Christianity, which was what he was surrounded with, you know, in Austria. One biographer writes that the future of an illusion was Freud's revenge. So he grows up angry about suffering discrimination from so-called Christians. So this book, The Future of an Illusion, this is his revenge against, quote, Christians, and for that matter, anybody who believes in God. He enters the University of Vienna at age 17. He's obviously a very bright guy. He graduates 9 years later with an MD. He's a medical doctor, and he begins working in the Vienna General Hospital, and he does that for about 4 years, and then he resigns and starts a private practice in which he specializes in nervous disorders, okay? And initially, he thinks it's effective to use hypnosis in his clinical work, and under hypnosis, patients will relate memories of traumatic experiences and incidents from their past. And he believes that this is a good way to discover why people are feeling and acting dysfunctionally, is because buried in their subconscious are these childhood traumas or even traumas from infancy that are not conscious to them, but this has distorted their perception of reality and so on. So he uses hypnosis, but he soon decides that what's revealed under hypnosis isn't necessarily all that accurate. He begins to question whether hypnosis is really an effective way at getting at people's internal problems. So he replaces hypnosis for the most part with what he calls psychoanalysis. And psychoanalysis is this attempt to bring these suppressed feelings and these suppressed thoughts into consciousness in order to free the patient as much as possible from suffering as a result of these repressed emotions. Now, he begins using what he calls free association to encourage patients to talk about their dreams and just whatever it is they're feeling. And he believes that this is, again, a more accurate way of getting at what's really going on, the psychodramas that are going on inside them. This is probably a better way of getting to the reality of the matter rather than putting them under hypnosis. And so in 1899, he publishes a book called The Interpretation of Dreams, in which he theorizes that dreams are a form of wish fulfillment. But this is just a theory hanging in midair. I mean, how could you possibly verify that scientifically? See, now he claims to be a scientist, but this is merely a theory. This is merely a philosophical theory. How could you possibly prove that dreams are an expression of wish fulfillment? And if you're like me, you've had interesting dreams that seem not to correlate one iota, you know, with wish fulfillment or anything like that. They're just kind of, you know, oftentimes they seem like just random synapse connections or misfires. As far as his family life, he marries a woman named Martha in 1886. Together they have six children. Now the most notable of these six children is a daughter named Anna. And it's going to be Anna Freud who continues her father's work and legacy. She becomes a world-renowned psychoanalyst herself in the 1920s and 30s and 40s and so on. Now, according to one of Freud's close friends early on, the psychologist Carl Jung, Freud carried on a long-term affair for many, many years with his wife's sister, who also lived with the family most of her adult life. So Carl Jung, who had a falling out with Freud, but apparently others verified this as well, that Freud carried on this sexual affair for many, many years with his wife's sister. Now, even before he began his career, Freud became addicted to cocaine. And he believed that cocaine was an effective antidepressant. I guess it can be in the short term, and a cure, he thought, for mental and physical problems, which it certainly is not. And he continues to use cocaine for at least 10 years, pretty much up until the late 1890s. And he did become addicted, and apparently he actually weaned himself or got himself off of cocaine. But we have to keep that in mind, that during this period of theoretical formulation, Freud is a regular cocaine user, and he's also positing this theory that, as we said, just kind of hangs in midair with no real scientific, you know, verification or validation or anything like that. Freud continued to live in Vienna virtually his entire adult life. In 1933, as you know, the Nazis took over in Germany. And within a year, the Nazis were burning all of Freud's books, along with, you know, lots of other authors as well. Freud quipped at the time, quote, "What progress we're making. In the Middle Ages, they would have burned me. Now, they're content with burning my books." Now, despite what's going on in Germany, he really is generally indifferent, say, to politics. You know, we have an awful lot of people in our country, including an awful lot of Christians, who are very indifferent to politics. They must think that they're above politics. And yet you look around at the horrors in the world today, and it's all perpetuated by evil politics, isn't it? What could be any more irresponsible, especially for a Christian, than to be a total ignoramus and disinterested in politics? Politics matters a great deal. It's not the solution to our, it's not the ultimate solution to any of our problems, but it does generate untold misery and suffering for people all over the world. But anyway, Freud, yeah, he's above all that, so he's very indifferent to politics. Then the Anschluss occurs in 1938, in other words, the German takeover of Austria. And the Gestapo arrest and interrogate his daughter, Anna Freud. And at that point, he becomes very interested in politics and what's going on, but it's too late then. So fortunately for him, he has very influential friends in America and Britain and throughout Europe who help him immigrate from Austria to Great Britain. So the last year of his life, he lives in Great Britain. Had he stayed behind, in all likelihood, he would have been thrown into a concentration camp and would have been murdered, just as his four sisters, who he left behind in Vienna, all four of them wound up in Nazi concentration camps and died, you know, under horrifying conditions. So a little bit about Freud's life. Any questions or comments before we move on? Yes, Jack. Pardon me? Yes, she did. Freud and I think all his children, including Anna Freud and some other friends, were able to get out of Austria in 1938. I think about a dozen, he and about a dozen others, through, again, very influential, well-connected friends in Britain and America. Yeah. Yeah, Bob. Right. Yeah, good point. And I'd say that this is one of the problems of what we would call in Christian history pietism. You know, this idea that the Christian life and Christian discipleship can be reduced purely to my personal relationship with Christ and my personal devotions and church attendance and things like that. But it's such a narrow-minded understanding of discipleship. You know, discipleship should be holistic, shouldn't it? And yeah, fundamentally, the Christian faith is not a religion. It's a spiritual relationship with God through faith in Jesus Christ and the communion with the Holy Spirit, the internal presence of God in our lives. That's essentially what Christianity is. But it's also a worldview. It's a comprehensive worldview. And when we reduce it to mere pietism, I think it's rather irresponsible. But you're right. I mean, for many Christians, that's all that matters is me and my relationship with God.
And there is a danger in getting so involved politically and even intellectually.
Yeah.
That all of a sudden they lose that personal walk with God.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right, and we need to consider first things first. But to say that there's priorities and first things first doesn't mean that the secondary issues are unimportant. It just means that they're secondary. Yeah, good point. Okay, well, let's do this. Let's talk for just a few minutes here because we're just about out of time. I've found over the years that it really helps to take a few minutes to talk about Freudian psychology, what I call Freudian Psychology 101, because some of you probably studied this maybe in college or something, but you know, it's been decades, and some people didn't even study it, you know, in college, and so, you know, we just hear little bits of pieces of what is supposed to be Freudian psychology, but I've found over the years that it really is helpful if we, again, just take a little while and go through the essentials of Freudian psychology so that we can critique it from a Christian biblical perspective. There are some things that Freud taught that seem to be undeniably true, and then there are other things that seem radically out of sync with a biblical Christian understanding of reality. So I hope this is instructional and informative and helpful for you as we go through this. So we start with what he would consider the reality of human nature, and that is that there's a conscious self and a subconscious self. and that human thinking and behavior are mysteries to the conscious mind. Now, hopefully this resonates with you to some extent. Think about some of the things that you think about and some of the things that you do, and where does that come from, you know? I think for all of us, we understand there's oftentimes kind of a mystery and a disconnect there. And Freud really emphasized that. Now, according to him, our consciousness, see, is merely the tip of the iceberg. Operating beneath the surface is an enormous amount of issues and thoughts and feelings that we're not even oftentimes conscious about. Now, by the way, if you've ever explored in depth the rich history of the contemplative Christian tradition, you understand that that's one of the great strengths of the contemplative tradition in Christianity, is that it forces us to get quiet, still, be still and know that I am God, and open our hearts and minds and allow God to reveal things about us in our inner self that otherwise we'd be unconscious and unaware of. And so, again, not everything Freud taught was just preposterous and absurd. There is some truth in some of this. So for the most part, he says, reality is buried beneath the surface in the realm of our subconscious. Now, he wasn't the first one to theorize about the subconscious, but he certainly is one of the foremost popularizers of this idea of the subconscious. The problem, though, see, for Freud, is that most people operate only on the surface level of consciousness. I think he's pretty much correct about that, including, you know, I'd say, you know, Christians as well. And this surface level is only a superficial expression of our true internal self. For the most part, see, we act and react according to our impulses and our emotions. Now, this is why, for instance, the great philosophers in ancient times, and we talked about, remember in our previous course, Socrates meets Jesus, we talked about how, for instance, great philosophers like Socrates emphasized that we have to live in accord with the principles of reason and morality, not on the basis of emotions. Socrates is very strong on this issue, as was Plato and others. We can't be emotion-driven. We have to operate according to our understanding of truth and morality and reason. And so Freud, say, is going to argue that we don't really know our true selves, and in most cases, we don't even understand why we think and we act the way we do. Now, what is the subconscious? Well, he says basically it's like a reservoir of past experiences and feelings, all this stuff inside of us that we're hardly even cognizant of. And bad experiences and memories, we tend to, quote, repress, and we store them in our subconscious. And this would include our hurts and our fears and our pains and our frustrations, our anxieties, our phobias, and so on. We tend to suppress those, see. But beneath the surface level, there's all these psychodramas being played out that sometimes seep to the surface, or sometimes they explode to the surface. And you think, wow, where did that emotion, or where did, you know, where'd that feeling come from? You know, gee, I wasn't even aware I had that in me. And Freud would say, well, yeah, you've just repressed it, say, over time. Now, this will be the last section real quickly that we'll cover here, and we'll pick up at this point next week. The problem is what he would call, we have a conflicted psyche. In other words, human beings are constantly struggling with two impulses. One, we want to be free. We have this, there's this quest for personal freedom and personal expression, see. And then secondly, though, we understand that we need to conform, at least to some extent, to society's expectations for what's proper and improper, okay? So we've got these feelings and sensations, but we understand, well, I can't just express myself just any way I feel, because that could damage my reputation and my standing with other people. So we have to, you know, we kind of have the struggle going back and forth. And so in his book that he wrote in 1923 called The Ego and the Id, Freud postulates that the human psyche has sort of a tripartite nature. And he says at our very base level is our id, and this is our basic psychological makeup. And it's our biological instincts, it's our animalistic impulses, and it's our emotions and our passions. And he says within the id is this vast reservoir of unconscious energy that's expressed or released via the principle, the pleasure principle, by way of the pleasure principle. And these impulses and drives are completely unconscious. So somebody who's driven strictly, see, by his animalistic passions and instincts and so on, we would call an idiot, right? That's an idiot in the true form. It's somebody that just expresses himself or herself any way they please, just, you know, on a whim, cares nothing about other people or their sensibilities or anything like that. That's a true idiot. Okay. Now, secondly, we have, though, regulating our id, we have what Freud would call a superego, and that's our social persona. In other words, that's the part of our psyche, see, that's conditioned by our social and economic and religious and political and other factors. And as such, it's the socialized image that we project to other people. Now, it's not the true us, but it is our persona that we project to other people. And when we understand, see, when we violate certain social norms, like if you were to call somebody an idiot, you know, for instance, the superego induces a sense of guilt within us. So we understand that we can't just be totally id-driven. We have to regulate our passions. So you got the id and you got the superego. Now, you've also got, however, an ego. And that's the conscious component of our psyche, see? And that's what mediates between the id and the superego and their conflicting demands. And so a life that was totally controlled by the id would be totally compulsive. It would be totally uninhibited. It would probably be very aggressive. It would be probably very antisocial. And it would be a very psychologically unhealthy life. But also, say, on the other extreme, a life that's purely controlled by the superego is also inhibited and repressed and superficial, and it's also unhealthy. And so, for instance, Freud would compare the relationship between the id and the ego to, for instance, a charioteer and his team of horses. And he would say that the horses, say, provide the energy and the drive, but the charioteer tries to control them and provides the direction that the chariot's going. So with that, we go into his idea for how we cope with this constant struggle in our lives between our impulses and what we feel like we should be like in front of other people. Okay, the impulse between the id and the superego. But again, unfortunately for time, we need to end at that point, and I hate to cut it off right midstream, but we'll come back and take up from that point next week. So I guess, you know, as far as what we can take away with what we've talked about so far, keep in mind, as C.S. Lewis pointed out in Mere Christianity, that there is, in a sense, a science of psychology, but there's also very strongly a philosophy associated with psychology. And Lewis put it, when Freud is speaking as a, quote, scientist, he has some good insights. But when Freud then crosses the line into theorizing and philosophizing, he's you know, out of touch with reality. He's out of his mind, and comes up with some just absurd speculations. So again, we'll try to glean the the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know, from what Freud has to offer, and critique it, again, from a biblical Christian worldview perspective. But I think as we go through this, you'll see that, oh, yeah, there's some real validity in some of this, and there's some wisdom in some of this. And then there's a lot that's just, again, patently absurd. So any questions or comments, anything before we suspend? All right. Well, nice being with you as always.